America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
So what should we do with Mr. Ahmadinejad? Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting day we're going to have today, by the way. This in the second hour of our program, we're going to be talking about the possibility of martial law in the United States. It's a very strange program that the Department of Homeland Security has come up with, working with ministers around the country to help suppress dissent, and some of the strange laws that have been passed. And just, you know, a general discussion and overview of that. In our third hour, will Ben Bernanke and the administration be able to postpone an economic disaster until after the election? And we're going to be talking with Art Levine, the truth about union busting and what's the state of labor. So just a whole bunch of stuff in that, you know, whole context in general coming up as we get into these issues. But first of all, And somehow my, here we go. My folders got completely backwards. First of all, Zbigniew Brzezinski over the weekend, talking, the National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter, talking about Iran and Iran's ambitions. This from CNN. Former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski likened U.S. officials' saber-rattling about Iran's alleged nuclear ambitions to similar statements made before the start of the Iraq War. He said, this was on CNN's late edition on Sunday with Wolf Blitzer, he said, "I think the administration, the president, and the vice president particularly are trying to hype the atmosphere, and that is reminiscent of what preceded the war in Iraq." Now, CNN also notes, and I think it's worth noting that they're noting this, that Ahmadinejad has said that Iran has no use for an atomic bomb. In fact, here's his exact quote. He said, "If it was useful, it would have prevented the downfall of the Soviet Union. If it was useful, it would have resolved the problem with the Americans that the Americans have in Iraq. The time of the bomb has passed." Similarly, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, the UN's atomic energy watchdog group, said last week it has verified that Iran's declared nuclear material has not been diverted from peaceful uses. And then on top of that, you have the fact that during the eight-year-long Iraq-Iran war, in which over a million people on both sides died, this is a brutal, vicious, god-awful, horrific war. In the Iraq-Iran war, we had Iraq, Saddam Hussein, using chemical and biological weapons against Iran, and Iran refusing to do the same back because they said the use of weapons of mass destruction was against their religion. It was wrong. So, interesting, all the demagoguery around, you know, and in fact, even, I mean, the famous quote, the infamous quote from Ahmadinejad that is repeatedly over and over and over again. People say that he says Israel must be wiped off the map. No. His actual quote was, "The Imam said this regime occupying Jerusalem must vanish from the page of time." And now, you could argue that there's not that much difference between the two, and I'm not going to take Ahmadinejad's side on that. Sorry, I'm just, you know, rhetoric is rhetoric. You know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words, etc. I was on Fox and Friends this morning debating this with Rich Lowry of the National Review, and it just seems to me that we've got a bunch of terrified right-wingers out there, you know, just absolutely terrified right-wingers. And I don't get it. I don't get what they're so afraid of. So something, you know, I'm missing something here. I just don't get it. Is Peter Ferrara with us by any chance? He is not. Okay, because I'm seeing a line punched down here on line 10. I didn't know. In the meantime, speaking of honoring generals, this is the thing. There's all this hyperbloviating and hysteriating about Petraeus or Petraeus, right? So let's listen to our leaders. This is the guy. He's in charge of CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command. This is Petraeus' boss, if my understanding of military hierarchy is right, the head of U.S. forces in the Middle East. This is from today's Financial Times. Has warned of the risk of mounting tensions between Washington and Iran, even as President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the West square off for a confrontation at the U.N. this week. And as the story goes on to say, Admiral William Fallon, head of the U.S. Central Command, gave one of the strongest indications yet that the U.S. military is deeply reluctant to consider military action against Tehran. Now, is this setting up a confrontation between the U.S. military and Dick Cheney? Again, quoting Admiral Fallon, the head of CENTCOM. He says, this constant drumbeat of conflict is what strikes me, which is not helpful and not useful. He says, I expect that there will be no war, and that is what we are working for. No war. The issue of no war. So what's going on?
We should have him on 9/11.
Ah, Peter Farrar is with us. Peter, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Peter. I saw you punched up on the board there for a while, but I thought
I heard you say a minute ago, Peter Farrar is not on the line, and I'm sitting there going, hey, wait a minute.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. You're with the American Civil Rights Union, sort of the right-wing analog of the American Civil Liberties Union, if I may describe it that way. I don't mean it as a pejorative. And
well, we don't take it as a pejorative.
Okay, great. Your general counsel, in fact, of the ACRU, theacru.com, by the way, the website. Why are you guys so terrified of Ahmadinejad speaking before Columbia University?
Well, I think the question is it appropriate for the president of Columbia University to invite him to speak?
Was it appropriate for the Council on Foreign Relations to invite him to speak?
Well, that's a good question as well. But
nobody's objecting to that.
Let me make my case. Would the president of Columbia invite David Duke to speak? Would the president of Columbia
David Duke is not the president of a nation of over 30, as I recall, maybe 50 million people.
When was the last time that the president of Columbia invited Newt Gingrich to speak there?
Newt Gingrich is not the president of a nation of over 30 million people. This is their world leader forum.
When was the last time the president of Columbia invited any conservative Republican to speak there?
The only conservative Republican right now who is the president of a major nation is George W. Bush. And I'll bet if he asked if he could speak at Columbia University, they'd invite him in a heartbeat.
When was the last time he invited any Republican to us to speak at Columbia?
This is their world leader forum, Peter. It is a forum into which they invite heads of state.
This guy's
a head of state.
Well, would he invite David Duke there? And if not, why not?
Because David Duke's not a head of state.
Because David Duke what?
He's not a head of state. He's not the president of a country.
Not a head of state?
Exactly. Head of state. He's not an elected official who leads a nation. This is their world leadership forum.
I dispute that.
You think that David Duke is a what country does David Duke run?
The guy's a dictator who took power by a fraudulent election, and that's obvious from the record. Why are you making excuses for this guy?
Wait a second. We're sitting here in a nation where our president was put into office by the Supreme Court, not the elected people. And in Iran, you've got a president, Ahmadinejad, who was actually elected with a large majority in an election that was overseen in part by the United States and certified as clean. And you think that he is less legitimate as a president, setting aside his ideology, I think, which we both can deplore many aspects of, than George W. Bush?
Hold on a minute. My son is in the high school government class, and they're teaching him about the Electoral College. Do we need to send you the documents on that, or what? Have you not heard about the Electoral College and how that
works?
What
about it? I'm quite familiar with it.
You're not required to have to be elected president of the United States. I'm sorry to have to explain this. You don't need a majority of the popular vote.
No, you need a majority of the electoral votes. Right,
and the electoral vote.
And the Supreme Court stopped the counting of the vote in Florida. And had it continued, by the way,
when
the New York Times did continue it.
The votes were counted five times in Florida.
And every single when they counted every single vote in the state, what they found was that Al Gore won. Peter, stick around. I know you were on hold for a while, and I apologize for that. Stick around, and we'll continue the conversation. Okay? Can you hold over the break?
Yeah.
Peter.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Great. We're talking with Peter Ferrara at theacru.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
It's past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we are talking with Peter Ferrara of the American Civil Rights Union, theacru.com. .com, Peter?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And the conservative...
.org. It's actually .org.
Oh, .org.
Yes, .org, yeah.
Thank you very much.
ACRU.org.
ACRU.org.
We couldn't use ACRU because that was like the Anaheim Fire Department or something. So
yeah, okay. You know, once again, I'm just mystified by this. John Kennedy, on February 26, 1962, he was speaking at the 20th anniversary of the Voice of America, and he said, "We are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values. For a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people."
It's not afraid of hearing what he has to say. Is why would you give a platform to a terrorist Nazi dictator? That's the problem. Why would you give a platform to a racist anti-Semite who wants to kill all the Jews? That's the question. Let me just ask you this question, okay? You know, in advance, in interest of the
first of all, let me challenge all of the statements that you just made. I mean, the guy's not a Nazi.
Yeah, I know. I heard the intro, and I heard your entire alternative reality. How the guy doesn't really have a.
Hey, my alternative reality. I read from this morning's Financial Times of London,
and they're not after the Jews, and all of this. It sounds like the German Bund in 1936.
I'm reading it from the conservative business press in England.
I heard that whole alternative. I just want to ask you this question. Suppose you're wrong, and suppose they do develop a nuclear weapon, and they nuke the Jews, and in fact, they send one over here, too, with a terrorist attack, and they figure if they nuke a city here, they think the same thing the Japs thought Pearl Harbor, that'll knock us out, and we'll never respond to them. Won't you be partially morally responsible for that? Won't that?
Well, and suppose the Martians create giant machines that are 30 feet tall and can spit fire. I mean, you know, your suppose logic. If you want a list of dictators in the world,
wouldn't you be partially morally culpable if that alternative reality turned out to be completely nuts and completely false?
What, for supporting and speaking at Columbia University? No, I wouldn't be.
The president of Colombia, what does he have to do with this? You're the one who got on the radio and made excuses for this guy and justified him and is constantly trying to stop America from taking him out now when it wouldn't be that difficult. And then my view is, yes, you would be. Blood would be on your hands because you're the guy who told us.
Respectfully, Peter.
No information at all.
Hang on just a second here.
You're standing up there on the radio. Running
Peter, let's not shout over each other, okay?
Okay.
Peter, calm down. Take a breath.
Morally responsible.
Yeah, okay. Take a breath. He is going to be taken out by his own people. Apparently, you haven't been following the goings-on in Iran. There is a strong middle-of-the-ground movement in Iran that is challenging Ahmadinejad, first of all. Secondly, as president of Iran, he doesn't have that much power. The real power is ultimately with the mullahs, who are essentially like a Supreme Court, and they can cancel. They can veto virtually any legislation.
He's their front, man.
He is speaking to a domestic constituency the same way that Bush is when he says outrageous things here that the majority of Americans don't agree with.
What are you talking about there? What'd you say?
He is speaking to his domestic constituency. He's a politician. He's a politician. If you want a list of countries that represent threats to the United States,
do you believe they have free elections in Iran?
Peter, I think, within boundaries, yes. I mean, do we have free elections in the United States? I can't vote for you in this coming election.
You don't think our elections are any more free than theirs? You think that they're
no? I think our elections are considerably more free than theirs. But that's not the point. That's not the point. The point is, let's put these things in perspective. We coexisted with the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons for 50 years. We coexist with Pakistan and India with nuclear weapons. We coexist with North Korea with a nuclear weapon. I mean, it's not, first of all, the IAEA, and again, as I said, you said I was reinventing history. I was reading it from this morning's Financial Times of London. This is the business, the conservative business press in the UK notes that the United Nations, the IAEA, who has had inspectors on the ground in Iran for quite some time now without restriction, that the IAEA says there is no evidence, zero, no evidence that they are enriching uranium beyond the 3.5% necessary for a nuclear reactor. It takes a 95%, 98% enrichment for a bomb. They're not doing that. They say they're not doing that.
Let me get into my perspective. The claim that Iran is building nuclear weapons is not an issue over which reasonable people can differ. And if you have any interest in the defense of the United States, you don't want to make excuses for the leading terrorist nation in the world.
So you think the IAEA is unreasonable?
Well, why did they refer them to for sanctions? Why did they refer them to the Security Council for sanctions if everything's so wonderful over there, according to the IAEA?
Well, the IAEA has not referred them for sanctions. We have. We'll have to leave it there. Peter Ferrara, theacru.org.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Just asking any bar. Although I screwed the country, they still think I'm a star. Hear neighbors trust their neighbors. That's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing. Yeah, I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. Besides, rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars. Forget about your cares, let's go to Mars.
Yeah, we don't need no national health care program. Let's just go to Mars. Oh, man. Welcome back. I just don't get it. I just don't get it. I said this morning on Fox News. I'm saying it now. I just don't get it. I think that Columbia University, by inviting President Ahmadinejad to speak, has shown confidence in the wisdom and the adultness of their students and of our republic. This guy's the president of a major nation in a vital part of the world, and we should have enough self-assurance and belief in our own system of government and in the intelligence of our college students that we can let them and our larger public evaluate his words, whatever they may be. To be terrified of his speaking there, or to try to censor it, or for that matter, laying a wreath at ground zero. This is the kind of behavior that you'd expect from a fragile regime like Khrushchev's Russia, or Khrushchev's Soviet Union, or Burma's military junta right now that's in the process of disintegrating. Not the bold, brave, and fearless USA. We are the nation whose President Nixon reached out to and met with China's Mao Zedong at the same time that Mao was funding and arming the North Vietnamese to kill our soldiers in Vietnam. We're the nation whose President Reagan confronted Soviet President Gorbachev, who at the time had thousands of nuclear warheads armed and pointed at us, and was actively funding and arming proxy wars we were fighting in more than a half dozen nations. We're the nation whose President Roosevelt said,
"Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
And let's also remember that the people of Tehran, Iran, produced one of the largest candlelight vigil demonstrations in the Muslim world in support of the USA in the day after 9/11, repudiating the act and the actors of that event. We still have a potential to make an ally of Iran, the country that shares a border with Iraq. And we shouldn't blow it by fear or bluster or bombs. America is better and stronger than the nervous Nellies and the chicken hawk warmongers who currently have control of the Republican Party. We are not afraid. We are Americans. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian.
Hi, yeah, I think you're right on target here. I did want to throw in something about the General Petraeus. About a week and a half ago, in the Independent newspaper in London, the one that's named the Independent, they reported that an Iraqi official was told by General Petraeus that he, Petraeus, was planning to run for president sometime, not in 2008, but sometime thereafter. And the reason I think this is important is that Bush had said, you know, the one thing he was going to do is he wasn't going to listen to politicians in Washington. He was going to go out and just listen to the generals in the field. And he picks the only general who's got plans to run for president.
Yeah, well, it could be. I think that the probabilities, and you know, thanks for the point, Ian, but I think the probabilities of Petraeus having a chance, even the faintest chance of having any kind of political success in the United States, other than maybe running for dog catcher in a rural county in West Virginia, is about zero. Len in Long Island, New York. Hey, Len.
Hi, my daughter is down at the UN with her whole school today protesting Ahmadinejad. And, you know,
good on her. I mean, that's the appropriate venue, is to speak out. If you don't like the guy, you speak out, but you don't forbid him from speaking.
Right. But, you know, he should be able to speak at Columbia, but at the same time, there should be ground rules. I mean, he's said things point blank, and then when he's questioned on it, he doesn't respond.
Sure.
You know, and unfortunately,
the guy's a weasel and a politician. We all agree.
Well, no, it's beyond that. I mean, you know, Holocaust deniers are not just weasel politicians. Those are guys who are trying to inflame people.
I agree.
Okay, so it's not a simple issue of being a politician. The problem is that we've lost our moral authority to just be able to, you know, make our case and be heard like Kennedy was when we had missiles pointed at us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told my daughter, if she were to carry a sign, I think they may be giving her signs, it would be after Ahmadinejad and Bush, then what?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Len, thank you very much. It's thank you. Tom in Yonkers, New York. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to say I really respect your intentions of bringing people like Mr. Ferrara on your show as a guest. But when I hear what a frothing, raving lunatic he sounds like, I really feel sorry for him, and I'm embarrassed for him. It's like I wish that you could arrange an intervention.
Okay, well,
because
it's
really doing him and your listeners no good to hear him like this. It's
yeah, well, I think for our listeners it might be interesting, but you know, as I tried to say to him, this is not Fox News, and we try not to shout over each other, but you know. You know, he'll come along. But Tom, thank you for your point. It's well made. It's and appreciated. Max, I don't have your city. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Los Angeles. What I am tired of is the logic of these knuckleheads like Peter who talk about, what if this happens? We need to shut this guy down. Now, that was what they said about Saddam Hussein going into this most recent adventure. And when I see these people on the Sunday shows and the news who talk about wanting an invasion of Iraq or Iran, we don't even have control in Iraq.
It was, by the way, what Hitler said of Poland.
We're looking down the road at these ridiculous military adventures, and I think what Columbia is doing is great, because the role of a university is to expand knowledge.
That's right. It's to foster debate. It's to encourage critical thinking.
Exactly. And lockstep with some political mentality that is clearly bankrupt.
Right. And the problem is that these conservatives don't understand or believe in critical thinking. I don't think any of them really even understand the concept. They believe in you do what the leader says. That's why, you know, Chris Matthews, I think, accurately pointed out, and I'm not sure he got how ironic and how frankly serious and tragic it is, the statement that he made, that the Republican Party is looking for leaders and the Democratic Party wants to have meetings. That meetings is what democracy is all about, and leadership is what kingdoms and aristocracy is all about. And meetings involves critical thinking, and leadership doesn't, or having leaders, following leaders, blindly following leaders. Joe in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
Your last three callers or so have been great. They're all on the money, and so are you. The thing I really noted right away was this fellow's sort of iconic for his point of view side need to immediately start impugning, like, your knowledge of electoral politics, what your motives are, instead of just being able to respond to your basic question about the fact that this was a world leader forum. And what does that have to do with when the Republicans have been invited there anytime recently?
Right. And in fact, I've gotten three emails now in the last 10 minutes from students at Columbia University saying that Republicans and right wingers are regularly invited to various forums at Columbia University. I know that the guy from the Minutemen recently got de-invited. I don't know the details of that. I would probably generally be opposed to such a thing. I think that, you know, all points of view should be represented, even the crackpots, frankly.
Definitely.
But it goes beyond that when somebody is the democratically elected president of a large nation that has a large military and that has huge influence in the region, then it becomes even more important that not only do you listen to them, but that you talk with them.
And that's something that.
Yeah. Well, not just confrontation. Conversation.
Is that what you?
Conversation. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Well said, Joe. Thank you very much. Absolutely. Amazing. Dan in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Dan.
Yeah. Good morning. Everything your guest said about Ahmadinejad, you know, more or lesser degree, everything he said, you could say the same thing about George Bush. You know, he's spreading hate and threatening people. On and on, you know.
I know, but it would have just egged him on. I mean, this morning when I was on Fox, Rich Lowry brought up the Hitler analogy, and I said, you know, come on, that's as silly as my saying that George Bush is Hitler. Neither one of these guys is Hitler. It does a disservice to the memory of those who were destroyed by Hitler.
To be worried more about what Bush is doing and what Ahmadinejad is doing.
Yeah, Ahmadinejad is a small-time politician who doesn't have a particularly large amount of power in his nation and is being confronted, frankly, in a very significant way by the moderates in his nation. And we are supporting him by trashing him and by trashing the moderates and by trashing his nation by implication. Thanks a lot for the call, Dan. Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Christy.
I watched Ahmadinejad last night in 60 Minutes, and when the reporter asked him what he liked about President Bush, he didn't have anything to say. He responded, "What do you like about President Bush?" And the reporter said, "Oh, he seems to be a very religious man." And Ahmadinejad replied, "What religion allows you to go in and invade a country, to kill their people, to take them over, to wiretap your own people?" He went on and on in that vein, and I thought, you know, this man really is not crazy. He's not what Bush has made him out to be.
No, he's a very smart politician, and he's a very crafty politician. And as I said, he's playing to his base in Iran, which is the hard right of Iran, just like Bush plays to his hard right base in the United States, which is not to make a moral equivalence between the two. But that's what's going on. Christy, thank you very much for the call. Got to take a break. You're 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be right back with more of your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Thank you. not Buddha, not Allah, not God sets us free. Not the person up front saying, listen to me. I won't give up my rights to a mere pack of thieves, wearing suits and big smiles with a trick up each sleeve. 'Cause it's our right to know all that they do, and they don't do a thing unless we tell them to. 'Cause they represent us, not those big wigs uptown. They wanna fight about that, then I'll go a few rounds.
9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, where my commentary on this issue posted over at the AirAmericaCom blog. It was on the Huffington Post blog for a while. It seems to have rolled off, and it's over at commondreams.org, right up at the top if you want to read it and share your thoughts about it. Joe in Paris, France. Hey, Joe, thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am well, but
not good. I agree with you completely about the question of not being afraid of Ahmadinejad coming to New York and Columbia University. And you know, if a jerk comes to a place such as a university and he's a jerk, I mean, who's the worst off for it? We knew this was going to happen, but that's not really the problem, I don't think. I look at the motivations of the conservatives who are militating against this, and I think to myself, these people aren't concerned about Ahmadinejad being a jerk. They're concerned about him sounding maybe a little reasonable, and maybe not being quite the devil that he's made out to be again and again and again in the press. And I mean, not to excuse some of the things that he said, but consider if these are, you know, if you're militating for war with Iran, the worst thing that can happen for your cause, and the thing that'll take the wind out of your sails sooner than anything, is imagining that your enemy isn't the devil that you expect him to be, or that you tried to present him as.
Yeah, they don't want him to have a public forum because it will punch a hole or pop the balloon or whatever the right metaphor is of the cartoon character that they're trying to create of him.
Now, yeah, this is the thing.
And yet at the same time, we have to acknowledge that this guy is a Holocaust denier. He did organize a conference to that end. He has said things that are frankly reprehensible, particularly about Israel. And yet he's not alone in the Arab world in doing that. In fact, he's not even unique in the Arab world in doing that.
If this is the sort of commentary that he produces when he's there, well then nobody's the worse off for it. You know, we've heard it again, and maybe these impressions are confirmed. But frankly, I don't think that's what's going to happen. And this is what I think that they're concerned about.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Joe. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to the web stream there in Paris, France. I shouldn't say the Arab world. I should say the Muslim world, because the Iranians don't consider themselves Arabs. They consider themselves Persians. Rich in Stratford, Connecticut. Hey, Rich.
Hi. I'd like somebody to point out that Iran supplied weapons to the insurgents in Iraq.
So
it's not
we.
Against international law. But we've done it for years, supplying the Mujahideen with weapons in the 80s, and we bragged about it.
In Afghanistan.
Nobody did anything.
We're supplying terrorists inside the country of Iraq, or of Iran, rather, with weapons to use against the Iranians. And it's you know, a relatively open secret.
Yeah, and for them to start saying that this is an act of war is going to tie the hands of our government for decades to come, because there are legitimate countries out there that we should try to do something about, but you don't want to go to war with them. And for them to say supplying weapons is now a justification for going to war. What happens when there is need to supply somebody with weapons yet not go to war? What are you going to do then? Just cry about it?
Well, and it goes beyond that. I mean, more than half of all the foreign fighters caught in Iraq have been Saudis. A very, very tiny percentage have been Iranians. And the weaponry coming into Iraq, the vast majority of the weaponry that is being used in Iraq against our people is weaponry that we ourselves brought into the country or was left over from the Saddam Hussein regime, and we failed to secure when we knocked down that country, and we completely ignored the weapons depots. The only building that we defended was the oil ministry. So, Rich, your point is well said and spot on. Sean in L.A. Hey, Sean. In Los Angeles, Sean.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great. What's up?
Greg, I just wanted to, you know, you made a comment earlier. It's a very good point that, you know, we basically don't want this guy to speak at a public forum because he may actually sound reasonable. And that's just pretty much going to take, you know, the whole wind out of the premise of us going to Iran, that he's not the devil that they make him out to be. Secondly,
yeah.
My point was that, you know, if the conservative media or all in general, basically, you know, want to condemn Columbia University for giving this guy a forum to speak, then they shouldn't actually, you know, publicize the whole event at all. They shouldn't have, you know, it live on the air when he's speaking at the forum. They shouldn't have any coverage. They should condemn it all, because if they're giving it any kind of publicity, basically what they're doing is it's a far larger viewership that they're allowing the
Well, this is their hysteria of the week. I mean, the fact of the matter is that right now he's speaking at the National Press Club. He is speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations, which is basically the ruling elite of the United States and arguably of the world. Nobody is complaining about those two things. What they're complaining about is Columbia University, because the conservatives have an instinctive and intrinsic dislike of universities, because universities tend to, A, be fairly liberal, and B, they promote this god-awful thing called education. Sean, thanks for the call. Scott in Springfield, just a few seconds here before we got to wrap up the hour.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I've been listening to Ahmed, the Iranian leader here, and I apologize because I can't pronounce his name correctly.
Ahmadinejad, yeah, that's okay.
But I would actually vote for this guy. He's actually speaking more or less the truth, and I mean,
well, in some regards, in other regards, I got to tell you, Scott, the guy is not, doesn't represent, I think, broadly the values that America represents.
Well, exactly.
I mean,
but if you put yourself in their shoes as a religious person over there who believes in Allah and the Muslim faith and all that, he's speaking like a leader. Like our presidents used to speak. I mean, he's talking about how people.
Well, that's my point. He's speaking to his base. He's speaking to his base. And as I said, he says some outrageous things, and it is not the exception in the Muslim world. It is the rule. And that's something that we need to address. And tragically, we're anti-addressing it. I mean, we're down to, in Turkey, which is our NATO ally or soon to be NATO ally, we have gone from more than 50% of Turks thinking that we're wonderful people before Bush came into 9% today.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What an amazing day. I mean, it's just so amazing. Speaking of the suppression of speech, which was essentially the theme of our first hour, what about the suppression of dissent? What about the suppression? What about the turning of Americans into good Germans? KLSA News, Channel 12, down in Shreveport, Louisiana, came across a fascinating story. Jeff Farrell apparently did the research work on this. And you're going to hear the newscaster. I don't have the name of the woman who's the newscaster introduce the story. And then a local chaplain, he's the chaplain for the Shreveport Fire Department and the Cato Sheriff's Office, Dr. Durrell Tuberville. And so let me just share a little piece of this. This is the consequence of a program which has been put into place by the Bush administration's Department of Homeland Security.
Law ever become a reality?
She starts out by saying, what if martial law ever became a reality?
Law ever become a reality in America? Some fear any nuclear, biological, or chemical attack on U.S. territory might trigger just that. And as KSLA News 12's Jeff Farrell discovered, the clergy would help the government with potentially their biggest problem.
Now, did you get that? The clergy would help the government with potentially their biggest problem? And so now she hands off the newscast to Jeff Farrell, the reporter for Shreveport's News 12, KLSA, or is it WLSA? Whatever it is here. Yeah. And WSLA. And Jeff Farrell picks up the story.
Us.
From my cold, dead hand.
Charlton Heston's famous declaration captures a truly American value, the overarching desire to protect our freedoms. But gun confiscation is exactly what happened during the state of emergency following Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. U.S. troops also arrived, something far easier to do even now thanks to last year's elimination of the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act.
Are you getting this? This is a local TV station talking about the fact that it's now possible for the U.S. Army to be used against civilians because we eliminated the Posse Comitatus Act. I'm just wondering how many people in Shreveport are watching that going, what's he talking about? You know, I didn't take civics in high school. I went to high school after Ronald Reagan was president, after the Republicans took civics out of high school. I just don't know what Posse Comitatus is. Posse Comitatus was the law that was passed in the 1870s during Reconstruction after the Civil War, in which we said we have had enough of an army turning its guns on civilians in this country, of our army shooting our people. It's never going to happen again. So from now on, henceforth, forevermore, world without end, amen, it is against the law for the Army of the United States to turn guns on the people of the United States. The only people who are licensed or who are authorized, legally authorized in the United States to pull a gun on you or me are the police. And the police are civilians, and they are responding to civilian, local civilian control. But the federal army may never do it until the Republicans controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House in the last session of Congress did away with the Posse Comitatus Act. I mean, you know, listen to this again. This is...
That forbid U.S. troops also arrived, something far easier to do even now thanks to last year's elimination of the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act. That forbid U.S. troops from policing on American soil. If martial law were enacted here at home, like depicted in the movie The Siege, easing public fears and quelling dissent would be critical. And that's exactly what the clergy response team, as it's called, helped accomplish in New Orleans.
What? This has already been done? If martial law were imposed, the number one thing is to calm down the people, to quell dissent, and that's exactly what the clergy response... How come we've never heard of this clergy response team? What is this thing? Well, Jeff continues.
Jeff, the primary thing that we say to anybody is let's cooperate and get this thing over with, and then we'll settle the differences once the crisis is over. So,
now, that's Dr. Darrell Tuberville, the pastor.
Clergy response teams would walk a tightrope between the needs of the government versus the wishes of the public.
In a lot of cases, these clergy would already be known in the neighborhoods in which they're helping to defuse that situation.
For the clergy, one of the biggest tools that they will have in helping calm the public down or obey the law is the Bible itself, specifically Romans, Romans 13.
Now, Romans 13, interestingly enough, says, keep in mind, by the way, these are not the words of Jesus. These are the words of Paul. A guy who came along long after Jesus had been crucified and basically reinvented Christianity, and at least in my opinion, and that of some biblical scholars. And Romans 13, this is Paul's letter to the Romans. He said, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. Now, there's a variety of translations of this. Some say governmental powers. Some say higher powers, meaning the powers of the church. Some say that being God. So here, let me read it again. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever there resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. This is the King James Version, by the way. Resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Now, it sounds like what he's saying is, if you resist government, you're going to be damned. Paul continues. He says, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. Now, see, that, again, brings it back around to suggest that what Paul is actually talking about is be faithful to the church. Do what the head of the church tells you to do. And in fact, later on in Romans 13, love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And he goes on, and the night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, and blah, blah, blah. So there are many who suggest that, in fact, the Bible is not the tool that should be used to justify being obedient to the government. For example, Darius was the leader back in the day when Daniel said, no, I'm not going to do what you say. And Darius threw Daniel in the lion's den. Remember the story of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They brought they were thrown into the fiery pit for not bowing to the leader. Moses' parents hid Moses from the Pharaoh. They didn't go along with the leader. Rahab lied to protect Hebrew spies. The apostles went to prison for preaching Christ and the authority of heaven. I mean, every single one of the 12 following Jesus were tortured and killed in horrible ways. By the way, this is from WorldNet Daily, the nice little summary of this. Paul and his followers in Acts 17 did contrary to all the decrees of Caesar in order to make Jesus the king. I mean, because Caesar said you can't have Jesus as the king. So how can you have the Department of Homeland Security, how can you have this government, the Bush administration, coming along and saying, oh, well, the Bible says that to be a Christian, you must be subservient to government. So let's just pick that up again and listen to the rest of this. This is, again, this newscast from this television station in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Because the government...
For the clergy, one of the biggest tools that they will have in helping calm the public down or obey the law is the Bible itself, specifically Romans, Romans 13.
Because the government is established by the Lord, and that's what we believe in the Christian faith. That's what's stated in the Scripture.
Civil rights advocates believe the amount of public cooperation may depend largely on how long they expect the suspension of their rights might last. Jeff Farrell, KSLA News 12 reporting.
According to Tuberville, during Hurricane Katrina, the clergy response team provided 38 chaplains a day around the clock at 8 different camps.
And it turns out, 8 different camps, 38 chaplains a day around the clock. It turns out the clergy response team is something that has been put together and is being coordinated by the Department of Homeland Security to train pastors all around the United States. And I'm assuming conservative Christian pastors. I'm not hearing about this drawing in, for example, Catholics or Jews or Muslims, but who knows? I mean, maybe it is, but as far as I can tell, this is an outreach to the guys who are getting the faith-based initiative money. You know that $1 billion that George Bush passed out before the last election? Another fine way to bring them in. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
So let's see, they've done away with habeas corpus, so anybody can be thrown into jail forever and never even told that there's a charge against them. They've done away with posse comitatus, so the U.S. Army can be used. The advantage of this, by the way, is that an Army officer from, say, New York City might be far less reluctant to turn a gun on somebody in, say, Alabama, or an Army officer from Alabama might be far less reluctant to turn a gun on somebody from New York City because it's not their local community. A point that the founders and framers observed, number one, and that, was made clear during Reconstruction. So we've got this fundamental realignment of the power of the federal government. The power of the federal government to suppress the people of the United States has been dramatically increased over the last 6 years of Republican rule, and I would argue over the last 26 years, ever since the end of the New Deal and the ushering in of the Reagan era, which continues to this day. We find, for example, the U.S. government is, this is from the Washington Post, the U.S. government is collecting electronic records on the travel habits of millions of Americans who fly, drive, or take cruises abroad, retaining data on the persons with whom they travel or plan to stay, the personal items they carry during their journeys, and even the books that travelers have carried. The personal travel documents are meant to be stored for as long as 15 years by the Homeland Security Department. The government is monitoring the personal habits of travelers more closely than it has previously acknowledged. The details were learned when a group of activists requested copies of official records in their own travel. This is a Freedom of Information Act filing, and that Freedom of Information Act filing came back, and they discovered that the government had kept records, including a description of a book on marijuana that one of them carried, and small flashlights bearing the symbol of a marijuana leaf. Oh, that's got to be a terrorist, right? Now, that's all kind of the bad news. How do we respond to this? I've been watching with absolute and utter fascination, and I'm seeing, frankly, I've been watching on BBC. I watch the BBC News every night, the American version. And they have led every night for the last three or four nights with this story of what's going on in Myanmar, in what used to be called Burma. Now, I've been on the border between Thailand and Burma, where the Karen people are fleeing Burma. In fact, we were at a refugee camp there. The Karen people fleeing Burma because they are the local indigenous people who are not viewed as good communist Burmese or whatever, good Burmese subjects. They weren't, you know, going along with the dictatorship. And there's thousands and thousands of these refugees on the Thai side of the border, and the Thais don't quite know what to do with them. It's a real mess. There's a number of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and they're working with them. And I was representing one at the time. This was 8 or 10 years ago, probably more like 8 years ago. And Burma is probably one of the most violently repressive governments in the world. This is where Aung San Suu Kyi, if I'm remembering her name correctly, I should have put it in front of me, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, has been under house arrest for all these years for speaking out against the military junta that's running Burma. And finally, a couple of weeks ago, the government, which controls, it's a very tightly controlled economy, they doubled the price of fuel, and people started protesting, small groups of people protesting, and the government brutally cracked down on them, throwing people in prison, beating them, and killing them. And the Buddhist monks of that country, people absolutely committed to nonviolence, people who own nothing more than the what do they call the thing, the robe, and in some cases sandals, many of them barefoot, and a begging bowl. I mean, that's it. The Buddhist monks said, okay, that's it. We're not putting up with this anymore. And it started out with 8,000 or 9,000 Buddhist monks walking through the streets of Rangoon and Yangon, the largest city in Burma, saying, that's it. And in fact, turning the bowls upside down, which is a way of saying we are withdrawing our blessing from this country, or at least from the leadership of this country, refusing to give blessings to the soldiers. And every day now for a week, I think it's a week and a half or so, these monks have been marching. And yesterday, over 100,000 people joined them. This is like Gandhi in India. This is like Martin Luther King in the United States. Here in the United States, we have groups like Women in Black, which goes, yeah, I mean, the history of Women in Black goes back to Black Sash in South Africa, to the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, the Seeking the Disappeared in Argentina. Back in 1918, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which, by the way, is still around. I spoke at their annual conference 3 years ago. And so we have nonviolent groups in the United States, the Quakers, the Society of Friends. But nonviolence, it looks like, is going to take down the government of Burma. Nonviolence, in my opinion, is the way to address this. So how do we most effectively do that in the United States? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, our blog over at airamerica.com. Click on the Tom Hartman page. Our message boards and live chat room over at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. We got an article up today at commondreams.org right now as well. Gloria in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Gloria, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. You are on the air.
Oh, thank you. Tom, I appreciate this opportunity to call in an answer to your question about how can this country affect change in the way that you were talking about in Burma. And you had a woman on the air about 4 or 5 weeks ago on a Friday. Don't remember her name. But she was talking about having been, you know, back in the hippie days of the massive demonstrations. And I remember your comment being taking a little bit of issue with her because you do, on occasion, go and you know, attend the vigils, et cetera. And I do, too. But I don't take issue with her. I do feel that this is way past time for us to get organized in a way that that rivals or surpasses the demonstrations that, for instance, you just saw recently with the case of the six.
Gina Six.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was going to ask you back on that Friday, kind of a rhetorical question, but when was the last time that you saw on TV a gathering of people so large that it took your breath away?
Yeah, well, it's
for me,
within the last few months,
immigration.
Frankly. I mean, there have been some very large ones, but you're right. Part of that though, Gloria, is not that those demonstrations are not happening. Part of it, I mean, I was in Washington D.C. for this March Against the War back 4 months ago or so, and Michael Lerner and I walked part of the way down to the near the White House, the main area there, and it simply wasn't covered.
I mean, exactly.
It was treated as a minor anecdote by the media.
Exactly. But my point is that the last time, for instance, that it took my breath away was to look at the demonstrations last year, I think it was, on immigrant rights, because what I saw there was a massive diversity of people. And if you looked at the
half million people in LA
that they were carrying, it wasn't just immigration. It was fair wages for fair jobs. I mean, it was the health care. It was everything. And what I'm saying is if we could what I was screaming at the TV was, let's us join all of those people. Obviously, they've got it together to, in a few days, organize nationwide massive, massive demonstrations.
And you know what organized that, Gloria? You know what organized that was Hispanic Talk Radio.
Well, yeah.
I think that, we have probably enough reach with progressive talk radio to get some effect in some cities, but it is nowhere near as large as Hispanic talk radio is in the United States. It is the fastest growing format in the field, and it's everywhere, even little teeny tiny towns. But your point is well taken, and I think that we do need to be taking to the streets, and we need to be taking to the streets in larger numbers. And But I think
that
there's...
You know, when it comes to media not covering them, what I'm saying is we need to take more steps than just stepping out and being viewed publicly. There must be some way that we can, that somebody who's got the brains to do it can tell us, okay, NBC isn't covering it. Okay, NBC is owned by GE. So for the next 3 days, da-da-da-da-da-da, whatever it is we need to do, stop buying this or...
No, it's that you simply reach a point where they can't ignore you anymore. And what concerns me is that what we're lacking at this point is that positive moral force, as opposed to rage, as opposed to anger, as opposed to knowing what we're against, that positive moral force that says this is what we're for. We're for a world of peace. We're for a world of justice. And there hasn't been, Martin Luther King did a brilliant job of galvanizing Americans around the concept of peace and justice. In fact, he became in his later years one of the most articulate spokesmen against the war in Vietnam, principally because he had that moral force. And, you know, such people are rare, but such movements are not. And they are out there. They're out there right now. I remember the last time I was up in Seattle. I don't get out much typically during the week here in Portland because I'm just, you know, I work 15 hours a day. But Louise and I were up in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and on the weekend, and just walking down the street, there were the women in black. You know, just standing there, just silent witness. And I think that that's really powerful stuff. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I actually think that the meeting, and I've participated in a few on Washington for peace, are effective. And you're right. There are other movements that are moving right now. One is the justice movement. It's kind of Afrocentric, but it's inclusive of everyone. They want everyone to join.
Sure.
And they're planning a march on Washington. One thing that I see that they didn't take into account was that once they got all the people there, what actual results did they want to see? And did they make those intentions clear?
Well, I think just making a statement is an important first step. I think it's a really important first step. And I also find it very, very powerful that in many of the cities of the United States, and I think it's frankly kind of waned during the summer, but particularly last year I was seeing a lot of this, that in many of the cities of the United States, you just virtually, not every street corner, but, you know, maybe every 10th street corner on bridge overpasses and things, you had people holding signs, you had people just standing there. We had a guy here who would dress up like Ben Franklin, you know, hold sign. I mean, some good stuff out there. And It seems to me that there's that moral authority that the monks in Burma are bringing to this is the thing that's making it work. And it may well be, frankly, that the religious in this country, and I don't mean the gratuitously religious, I'm not talking about the religious Reich, but the you know, there are many churches, the United Church of Christ, for example, that are strongly opposed to this war and are highly inclusive.
Yeah,
and for that matter, the United Methodist Church that I grew up in and that Dick Cheney and George Bush are both members of has come out and spoken out against the war in Iraq and against the Bush policies.
Absolutely.
So why are they not mobilizing their people in the streets? I would like anybody who is participating in their church to start raising this issue with their pastor to say, you know, why do we not as a congregation get out there and get more active? Why do we not as a synagogue get out there and get more active? Why do we not as a mosque get out there and get more active? I think it's the time has come that it's really important that we just start speaking out and not just speaking out, being present. And there's something different between being present and being angry, because I've been part of angry demonstrations, too. And, you know, going all the way back to the 1960s, I've had tear gas thrown at me. I've been through it. Right. And the being present stuff, I have to tell you, is ultimately much more powerful than the being angry stuff. Rick in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Rick.
Rick.
Rick. Hi. In Phoenix. Hey.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I originally had a comment about the Ahmadinejad speech, and we're a little past that, but this kind of segues into the maybe the Burma thing. Didn't Lincoln say something to the effect that you don't make peace by only talking to your friends? You have to talk
yeah. to... Yeah, you have to talk to your enemies. And that's one of the things about that moral force of being present, is that it is not a confrontational force in a sense that is interpreted as violence. And I mean, that was the incredible power when Martin Luther King and not just King, when the nonviolent civil rights movement in the 1960s allowed the fire hoses to be turned on them and allowed the dogs to be turned on them and stood there and said, "We're here. We're not going away." Jim in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Boy, there's so many points to cover here. I don't think we're lacking the moral force. I think that the media is lacking the moral force.
Oh, well, the media has no moral force at all. It has a commitment to money, period.
Exactly. It's the presence and the stepping out individually in our individual lives. Your examples that you give here are times when you were on the street in person and see the women in black or attend the demonstrations. That's where the presence is. Just have to get away from seeing it shown to us and instead turning inward and knowing that we can do the right. Just step forward and say, take it up with our congregations and our temples and ask to mobilize and get out and make personal commitments and personal presence. I'm quite upset with the promotion as a question, I understood the hour's topic was to be whether the government was planning for martial
Now, what's
law.
The most effective way to oppose government suppression of dissent? And I think nonviolence, frankly, is the most effective way to suppress it. But, and Jim, I got to move along. I appreciate your call, but we'll continue the conversation right after this break. Let me share some thoughts on the Dalai Lama with you as well. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
You know, getting it ain't hard. You just sign along the dotted line. You can take it home today. Buddy, let me tell you, you're gonna pay and pay and pay. Oh, MasterCard, you mastered me. I'll still be paying when I'm 83. Things I bought are broke or gone. Oh, MasterCard, where'd I go wrong?
9.5 minutes before the hour. Strange stuff going on out there in the world, by the way. Very strange stuff. Japan's leading toilet manufacturer, Toto, I mean, this makes the Mattel toy recall look pedestrian. They're offering free repairs to 180,000 toilets across Japan after three reported incidents of serious injuries because their toilets caught fire. Yeah. Z-Series feature a power dryer, a tornado wash flush, a pulsating massage spray, and an automatic lid. Yeah. Electric toilets, not a good idea. Okay, the Dalai Lama. Back, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I was part of a group, some 20-some-odd of us. Actually, the film about this just won Best Documentary in the Sundance Film Festival last week. And it's about the Dalai Lama. And there were 20-some-odd of us, I think 24, 28, whatever it was, who were invited to spend a week with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. and talk about what we can do to bring about a world at peace. And there was a strong contingent that wanted the Dalai Lama to call for an economic boycott of China, because China has murdered over a million Tibetans and continues to repress and to murder Tibetans and to repress that country. And he argued that if we were to do that, that the economic damage, that the damage to China would harm particularly rural people, but people by and large in China who had nothing to do with the political situation. In fact, he said, isn't it possible people could die of starvation if China's economy were badly injured? And one of the fellows who was in our group, who had been one of the leaders of the South African boycott movement, said, yeah, thousands of people in South Africa died, starved as a consequence of the South African boycotts. That's sometimes the price you pay for freedom. And the Dalai Lama said, well, if even one child dies as a consequence of actions we take in this room, it's too high a price to pay. And I, you know, I've told the story before. Up to that point, I had always felt that there was an us and a them. There was me and my friends inside this circle, and then there's this line in the sand around us, and there's everybody else out there, right? And he had come along with his little whisk broom and just brushed away the line and the circle and said, sorry, there's no them. It's all us. And when you get it that it's all us, it kind of changes your perspective on what's the most effective way to do things. Patty in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Patty.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. You know, interesting discussion, and talking about bringing peace to the world, well, that's a pretty big order to fill. But there are groups that are very active in that right now. As you know, you've been promoting creation of a U.S. Department of Peace, and the Peace Alliance just held their peace walks about 2 weeks ago. September 21st was International Peace Day, and they are pro-peace. They are an organization that is working to create this agency, which will then lay the foundations to create more peaceful communities.
When you're talking about Marianne Williamson organization.
Correct.
Yeah, I was on the board of that for a couple of years. I'm very familiar with them.
That's right. Well, you know, but that's an example of a group that if people got behind that group, because right now in Japan is the third global peace summit, and there are about, I think, 25 different countries, many from Africa that are first-timers, looking for ways to create their own departments or ministries of peace that would interface with other departments and ministries of peace around the world that would look for nonviolent means of resolving conflict. And just as violence is learned behavior, so is how to nonviolently resolve conflict.
And so is peace. I mean, this is the big point, Patty, and that is that peace is an active thing. Peace is a process. Peace is not the absence of violence. And that's one of the big myths of our culture, is that peace is the absence of violence. Peace is something you have to work at. It's like having a good marriage or a good relationship or a good friendship. It's something that you work at. And it's a positive force. And there's a lot of organizations out there who are promoting this. And I believe that having a cabinet level Department of Peace would be a great thing. Patty, I've got to move along, but thank you for raising that point and making it. You said it very well. Paige in Denver. Hey, Paige.
Wow, that's fascinating what the woman just said. Thank you for having me on the show, by the way. Because what I was calling about was actually that Denis Kucinich does have a plan for the Department of Peace, and I think that would be a wonderful way to address those issues within the United States.
Yeah, I agree. If there was somebody sitting, whenever the president was sitting with his cabinet, if there was somebody sitting in that circle as a member of the cabinet, and their job was to figure out how to bring about peace, rather than not have war, or rather than to fight a war, I think that would be a positive thing. I think it would just be a very, very positive thing. So, you know, it's the peace movement. Gwyneth in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Gwyneth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I think in preparation for nonviolent demonstrations, we all ought to be aware that our military and our police have lost a lot of funding, and we have a lot of common ground with them. We ought to be working to make friends with them to make sure that there's less violence from them, and even though they have to do their job, they may be willing to do it a bit less violently.
Exactly.
And support us in some ways so that we can have more massive demonstrations and closer to the capitals of our respective states and the White House and the Capitol in Washington, D.C.
Well said. Peace, again, is a positive force. It's a proactive force. It's a reaching out. It requires effort. And sometimes it is the most difficult of efforts. Sometimes it's a fatal effort. I mean, look at the hundreds of thousands of people throughout history who, in the name of peace, have given up their lives. And yet, it is the most powerful moral force there is.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So here's this story in cnews.canoe.ca, Canadian news. Right, in the Canadian News Service, Sun Media, one of the Canadian, you know, like Reuters kind of thing. Hundreds of angry and loud tradespeople laid Alberta's labor code to rest in a dramatic mock funeral at the legislature yesterday following a bagpiper and flanked by men dressed as the Grim Reaper and a priest. Electrician Eric Klein carrying a plaque inscribed with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which I believe is the Canadian equivalent of our Bill of Rights, led a funeral procession from 108th Street to the steps of the legislature. Followed by more than 300 laborers and supporters, six pallbearers carried a wooden coffin draped with a Canadian flag and laid it on the legislature's steps in front of a tombstone that said RIP Alberta Labor Code 2209-2007, 22nd September 2007. Well, at least in Canada, they're doing some good theater out there. Here in the United States, labor seems to be dying. And this is, by the way, this is happening all over the world. As corporatism spreads, as governments increasingly are being taken over by corporatists or fascists or neoliberals or whatever you want to call it, and labor is being disempowered in ways that, frankly, if you go back and read the Wagner Act that was passed in 1935 here in the United States during the Franklin Roosevelt administration, are illegal. Art Levine is a contributing editor to the Washington Monthly. For the magazine In These Times, he wrote an article called Union Busting Confidential. You can find it over at inthesetimes.com. He went underground. Our question for the hour, by the way, and we'll get to this in a little more detail in just a minute, but this is a piece of it, is will Ben Bernanke and the administration be able to postpone an economic disaster until after the election? Because I'm of the opinion that that's what they're all about. Art, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me on. I enjoy your show, and I'm a big fan of Air America, and I'm a subscriber to Air America Premium. So I'm
great.
I follow it.
Thank you on all counts. You went underground into a union-busting seminar.
That's right. The way I did it was my family has, like, one building that we own. You know, it's like one building that we own in Queens. And so I'm listed officially as Arthur S. Levine, vice president of a particular real estate company. So what I did was, because I have a legitimate title, I used that as my cover to go as a reporter. And so they do a lot of due diligence because they don't want journalists there. They don't want union spies. And so I went in there as a vice president of a real estate company, concerned that we owned lots of properties, and I was a big landlord, and SEIU was organizing janitors, and I needed their help. That was my cover story. So
and by the way, SEIU is organizing janitors, and a lot of landlords are up in arms about it.
That's right. They're trying to give them living wages so they can support their families. So I was there to try to that was the cover story, that I was there to basically absorb their lessons about how to deflect union organizing. And the more disturbing thing is actually, while they violate the spirit of the law in what they're proposed, they don't really violate the letter of the law, because the law is so weak and has so many loopholes. So the key thing that's super scary and disturbing about the law is, that's why the law needs to be changed. And there's a bill in Congress called the Employee Free Choice Act that would do that, is there's so many ways under the law to thwart unions from legitimately organizing. And that's what these guys were doing. They were giving us legal advice about how to worm our way around the spirit of a law that was designed to promote organizing.
Right, although a lot of these loopholes are things that have been put in place since Reagan came into power, some by executive order, some by changes in the regulations within
sure.
the Department of Labor,
sure.
Some actually by legislation passed by largely Republican Congresses.
Right.
Although Bill Clinton didn't, he was a gentle friend of labor, but he could have taken an axe to this thing and taken it all the way back.
Oh,
to,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
In other words, this area of this weak labor law, I mean, I had initially done reporting on this back in Florida in the 90s, late 90s and before Clinton came in, and there were still horror stories going on. And essentially it's so bad in so many areas that at one point, several years ago, I think it was Human Rights Watch did a whole report about human rights abuses as part of the abuses against the unions and their members in trying to organize.
Right. So, and this, by the way, has become, according to my friend Tom Chamberlain, who's the president of the AFL-CIO here in Oregon, has become a billion-dollar industry, advising companies on how to bust unions.
Absolutely. And what they do is they basically first try to scare you about, you know, how omnipresent human unions are, and that they're going to destroy you. And their big concern now are these public campaigns, which are unions mount to build public pressure, because the laws are so weak and the corporations on their own won't give in to reasonable union regard for organizing, that they build public campaigns where they, you know, go to the press and they build coalitions in a community. And this frightens corporations. So our lawyers from this law firm named Jackson Lewis were telling us, you know, the big damage is not that you're going to be organized from within. It's that you're going to be organized from without. And this is, and their scariest devil figure, almost like, to them, the equivalent of the Antichrist is Andy Stern of SEIU. They view him as like some kind of smooth talking figure who has the power to cloud men's minds. You've got to watch.
Which is interesting, because I think Andy Stern is a little too conservative for my taste, frankly.
Right.
But you know, I think he's a good guy, but you know, I disagree with him on a lot of things.
He presents a very appealing manner. So at one point, you know, and it's built up as if now we're going to watch it, and they had to prepare them because this is so all-powerful a presentation. They darken the room, and they screen an interview of Andy Stern giving an interview to CNBC, in which he sounded absolutely reasonable. He says things like, I think we need to find ways to add value and employers and not make them uncompetitive. And he points out that, you know, union workers earn more than 9,000 more than other workers, are twice as likely to have union than non-union workers have insurance. And then when the lights go up, one of the lawyers running seminar goes, very impressive. Would your people find him inspiring? Yes, they would. And this is like, oh, God, we've got to deal with this menace of, you know, more rights, more opportunities.
And so all across America right now, as we speak, there are seminars and workshops being held by these various mostly law firms, teaching or consultancies, shall we say,
right,
teaching
employers
right, how to prevent unionization.
Yeah, there's not only that. There's about, by some estimates, there's as many as 2,500 consultants and lawyers offering their services. Now, most of the services, as I understand it, are not in these seminars, which are relatively low cost for big companies. I mean, when I went along to it, it was about $1,500, and now they've dropped the price. The seminars are not where they make their money. Where they make it are these very, you know, expensive you know, being brought on as advisors. And by some analysts of this industry find that the cost to the company for running an anti-union campaign is $3,000 per each worker in your law, in your company. So, I mean, that, you know, in a big company, that can really add up. And so they're willing to spend that kind of money because they don't want to offer people, you know, a decent health care or the ability to have a living wage so they can support their family. They really want to keep them, you know, as crushed as possible.
Well, and the other big threat is that a labor union essentially is democracy. I mean, unions are democratic institutions. They have members who vote and determine their leadership and determine their policies.
Right.
And corporations are not. Corporations are kingdoms. They're set up along the old-fashioned model of kingdoms. And kingdoms have always collided with democracies.
Well, and under the current system, the law is so weak and enforcement is so terrible that like one in five outspoken union supporters are fired when trying to form unions. And then more than three quarters of employers are forced
to finish
go one on one with their bosses.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing. Art Levine is the author of the article. In These Times is the publication. InTheseTimes.com. You can find it on the web. Union Busting Confidential. Art, great work. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been? I ain't had the mysteries since you've been gone. Hello, trouble, trouble, trouble. Welcome home.
Well, today the first strike by the United Automobile Workers began since 1970. That strike lasted 2 months, according to the New York Times. UA struck GM at two plants in Flint, Michigan in 98, a strike that went on for 7 weeks. But this is the first national strike. Ron Gettelfinger, the union's president, said, "This is nothing we wanted. Nobody wins in a strike, but hey." Two sides apparently hit a stalemate. This is from today's New York Times over the union's demand for job protection for its workforce at GM, which is one-fifth its size in 1990. GM, in return, had pushed for the creation of a trust that would assume responsibility for its $55 billion liability for health care benefits for workers, retirees, and their families. You would think they would have been planning for that all along, since these are, you know, real expenses that could have been easily predicted. So here we have a strike, an actual strike going on. Good on you, Ron Gettelfinger. You know, when I started in... Well, when I started in radio, it was back in 1968, and it was a little station in Lansing, Michigan, WITL. It was actually the biggest station in Lansing, Michigan. It was a country western station. And then went to a rock and roll station, et cetera. But when I started doing this program, this one that you're listening to now, it was about 5 years ago. We were in our fifth year. And it was on the IE America radio network, which at that time was owned by the United Automobile Workers, the UAW. So... And Ron Gettelfinger was in charge of the thing, and they ultimately shut it down when Air America came along. But interesting. So I have some, I guess, history with the UAW, and of course, most of my friends were UAW members. Many of my friends, or at least their parents. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, big GM factory in Lansing, Michigan, and a lot of my friends actually, you know, worked their way through college working at the General Motors factory in Michigan as UAW members. So I wish them well. The point that I wanted to make of this whole thing, here's the question. Will Ben Bernanke and the administration be able to postpone an economic disaster until after the election? Historically, we have always understood that the thing that drives an economy is demand. People want to buy things. And if they have the money to buy things and they want to buy things, then entrepreneurs will step forward, businesses will step forward and say, okay, cool, we'll sell you that, or we'll make that. We'll make that available. We'll provide that. Pretty straightforward stuff, right? This is not rocket science. And this is how, you know, go back and read Adam Smith. Go back and read David Ricardo. Go back and read John Stuart Mill. I mean, this is how it worked 7,000 years ago in Uruk, you know, in northern Iraq at the time of Gilgamesh. And about 30 years ago, this weird notion came along called supply-side economics. Because, see, this is demand-side economics. If there's demand, you do something. Several of the businesses that Louise and I have created and built up and sold off over the years, we did because we saw a need in the marketplace. We said, hey, you know, there's nobody doing this. There's nobody filling this market niche. We can do that, and we can make some money at it. We saw demand, and we created supply, and made money at, and in some cases made a lot of money at it. Now, you know, relatively speaking, I mean, I'm certainly not Warren Buffett, but did okay. So anyhow, this weird notion came along with Reagan that George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, referred to as voodoo economics. That's really not how it works. And that really what it's all about is if there's a lot of stuff available, that will cause people to want it, and they will buy it. Demand-side economics. Supply-side economics. And so if you can increase the supply, then that will stimulate the economy and drive the economy. And so they tried this out. They said, instead of putting more money in the pockets of people who have demand, which is what Franklin Roosevelt had done and Dwight Eisenhower and Harry Truman did and Dwight Eisenhower did and John Kennedy did and Richard Nixon did and Lyndon Johnson did and Jimmy Carter did and you know, in a very large way, all of the presidents all the way back to George Washington and kings before that. Instead of doing that, instead of putting money in the pockets of the people through things like minimum wage and unionization laws and like that. Instead of putting money in the pockets of the average person to generate demand, let's put money in the pockets of the people who own the factories so that they'll make more stuff. And by making more stuff and building more factories, they'll create more supply, and that will cause people to buy it. Well, what happened was, yeah, they created more supply, and people said, oh, this is cool, I'd like to have this stuff, but I don't have any money. And it looked like it was going to fall apart. I mean, you know, there was this horrible Reagan recession. And so Alan Greenspan comes along and says, well, I know how, I have a solution for this. We'll make it easier for people to borrow money so that they can buy the things that they want. Now, this is a fancy way of through the back door, actually bringing about demand side economics and calling it supply side economics. Because by loaning people money, by easy credit, what you're doing is you're increasing demand. But what it did is it threw the entire middle class into poverty for all practical purposes. When my dad died last year, his house was completely paid off. Most people in their 30s and 40s these days, their house is 90% mortgaged, 95% mortgaged. Are they going to pass it along to their children? Probably not. Because they've been living off it because of this whole credit thing. This is the destruction of America in many ways.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-3023-2270. Well, in fact, Jen in D.C. actually did hear this on the radio and says about our exploding toilets. What you don't understand, Tom, is the Japanese toilets are actually absolutely the most comfortable things ever. You can sit in there forever. Your seat's warmed. You're getting a gentle massage. Spray automatic dryer. It's heaven. Signed, Jen in D.C., who has never had one catch fire under her hindquarters. Well, good luck, Jen. You might want to check the serial number and make sure that your toilet is not one of those involved in the recall. Boy, Ahmadinejad really got his butt roasted. Speaking of that, see Lisi Bollinger, Columbia's president, the president of Columbia University, just absolutely went after him in a variety of ways. It's being blogged over at the New York Times. He said, Mr. President, he's speaking to Ahmadinejad, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator. And so I ask you, why have women members of the Baha'i faith, homosexuals, and so many of our academic colleagues become targets of persecution in your country? He confronted Mr. Ahmadinejad over his description of the Holocaust as a fabricated legend, calling him either brazenly provocative or astonishingly uneducated. He referred to the Holocaust as the most documented event in world history. He asserted that Iran had a poor human rights record and that Iran leads the world in executing minors. He also spoke of a wider crackdown on student activities, including the jailing and forced retirement of scholars. Interesting. And Ahmadinejad, the New York Times blogger talking about what Ahmadinejad said, it reads like, and I refer you over to nytimes.com, you can read the whole thing. It reads like Ahmadinejad was basically saying, you know, science is being used as a tool of oppression by modern, largely Western civilization, and so instead we should turn to the divine. In other words, the guy's a religious fanatic. He also said making chemical, nuclear, and biological bombs and weapons of mass destruction is yet another result of the misuse of science and research by the big powers. Keep in mind, again, that during the war with Iraq, Iran refused, even though Iraq hit them with chemical weapons, Iran refused to respond in kind because they felt it was against their religion. So it's like it's nothing simple here. Right. This is it's not good guys versus bad guys. It's like religious fanatics against religious fanatics. It's well, what can I say? I just want to finish up this thing on the economy and then we'll take your phone calls. Historically, demand side economics is what has driven economies and it's what's grown economies. When Reagan declared the end of the New Deal, for all practical purposes.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah. And so when they began doing something about that, destroying the protections of labor, freezing the minimum wage, cutting back on unemployment insurance, destroying welfare programs, running inflation in ways relative to Social Security that it became harder and harder to live on a Social Security check, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As they started destroying the New Deal and throwing more and more money up to inherited wealth and I mean, you know, now if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, you pay a maximum 15% income tax, whereas if you work by the sweat of your brow or the sweat of your back, you can pay, you know, well into the 30% income tax. I mean, this is one of the wonderful things the Bush has brought us. Is that people who make money with money pay a much lower income tax rate than people who make money with work. They actually think that's a good thing. It's not. And so what has happened is we have an economy now that the only thing that has been keeping this thing afloat for 26 years since Reagan ran up the largest deficit in the history of the United States, larger than every president before him combined, and now Bush has beat Reagan. And we're spending enough now just on the interest on the national debt to completely repair and rebuild all of our schools and bridges in the United States. But sorry, we can't do that because we have to pay for the interest on these things. That the bill is coming due. The bill is coming due. We are so badly in debt. We are in debt to the rest of the world to the point that they're coming in and they're buying up our companies, over 15,000 of them now over the last 30 years. They're buying our infrastructure. They're buying our minerals. They're buying our forests. They're buying our buildings. We are working for them. And where do the profits go from these companies? They go back to those other countries. You've got the Dubai and the United Arab Emirates now, you know, buying the London Stock Exchange. Now they're looking at the Amex. Maybe it's the Nasdaq. So it's the selling off of America. So first of all, they threw us totally into hock for 26 years to try and make the economy look like it was good. And who makes money on that? The people who are lending the money. And who's lending the money? The people who have inherited wealth from the largest corporations and the banks. Are you starting to see a pattern here? And now when nobody can pay it back, they say, that's fine. You can just sell everything off. Sell off your business. Sell off your home. And so we're going to become a nation of renters. This is what they have in mind. It is not too late to stop. If we were to simply go back to the tax policies that we had under Richard Nixon, the income tax policies, if we were simply to remove the cap on the Social Security tax so that Bill Gates and I both pay the exact same percentage of income tax or of Social Security tax, if we simply did those two things, we could have national health insurance, the Social Security fund would be solvent forever, and we could begin paying down the national debt quite rapidly. But these guys want to make sure that the millionaires and billionaires get richer and richer and richer, and that the middle class is progressively and continually disempowered because they think that it's a social good. They really and truly do. The conservative philosophy on this is explicit. Read it. I mean, William F. Buckley has written about this. Russell Kirk's book, The Conservative Mind, 1953, it's still a classic. It's still a bestseller, probably the best book of all. It's referred to by all the conservatives constantly. Society should have orders and classes. When the middle class is too well off, they get uppity. And that's not a good thing because it leads to social instability. So you have to have the working poor as the main populace of the United States rather than the middle class. A middle class, bad thing. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Every September 11th, we have a more important anniversary to me than the Trade Center, and that's the founding of Satyagraha by Gandhi. And I think that's what we really need to remember. And Satyagraha means basically holding on to the truth. And
did Gandhi begin his nonviolent movement against the British occupation on September 11th?
September 11th, 1906, so 101 years ago in a couple of weeks.
I think you told me that once before, and I've since spaced it.
Yeah, and so we need, and the other thing is he based his work on ahimsa, which is absolute nonviolence, even nonviolence of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to study that. And the thing is, and it's ironic that I was just playing with the whole thing of soft power and hard power recently and saying, you know, we named that wrong. Soft power being, you know, the power of attraction and so forth. I think we need to call it true power and false power. You know, hard power, which is a power force, is really not power at all. And ironically, Thich Nhat Hanh just came out with a book about true power. And so it's worth us looking at. And so imagine right now we need to stop being against things. We need to be for things and attract people to our way, as you know Dick Gregory said. And we need to act, not react. But one of the things as far as the movement is concerned, we need to start ignoring the media. I mean, do you want to be validated by someone who sees the blonde and black as credible? Imagine the strength right now if you ignore the media, but you gather 100,000 people in silence, not screaming people, but 100,000 people in silence in D.C.
Or even attention. 5 people on every street corner in your neighborhood.
Exactly. Well, there's the thing. It's like, for a long time, I've been suggesting we do distributed protests. A lot of people in small towns can't drive the 500 miles to the big city or whatever. Do it in your neighborhood. Imagine driving through your city, and every 10 blocks, you see 5 people on the corner.
Yeah.
Don't wait for a group to do something. You lead the way right now.
Yeah, and there are people doing this. There are people doing this all over the country, and God bless them. And we need more of them.
Jeff,
thank you very much, and thanks for reminding me of September 11 and that anniversary. Joe in Long Island. Hey, Joe, got about a half a minute before we got to take a break. Is this a quick one?
Yep, it is. Tom, I agree with you 100%. I'm going to make this really quick. Just let me go on it. The Federal Reserve is the biggest problem that we have. It's a private entity, and I never hear talking heads talk about this. I don't know why. They are fleecing this nation. As they pump liquidity in, that is a tax to us. That is a tax in the form of creating more debt. Helicopter Ben is printing more money. As he prints more money, our dollar becomes less and less. The GM strike from today is probably all by design. They want to dissolve the union. They want the North American Union. They want the Amero. And the Federal Reserve, this corrupt entity, is fleecing the middle class. That's what you need to discuss, Tom.
I believe it was the first hour. I mentioned, Joe, the Fed is a private bank. It's a private institution. It's not a government institution. Oh, no, maybe it was yesterday. In any case, yes, I don't disagree with anything you said. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in the lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime.
Right.
So it's me when I come.
Good luck, Johnny. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, the UAW on strike. Speaking of auto workers, Victoria Jones on the line with us at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you.
What's up? Yeah, it's nice to hear your voice again. It's been a long time since we've talked.
It has been a long, long time, I know, and I've missed you tremendously.
Well, and me too. I always enjoy our conversations. So, what's up in your part of the world there?
Well, in my part of I'm pining, of course, because the president's out of town for 3 days, and I'm barely coping with the loss. But what he's doing today is his first order of business was meeting with the leaders of the Palestinian Authority, because he's trying to get Middle East peace and world peace and everything jolly by the end of his visit to New York. Then he was getting an update on the peace process from Tony Blair. What he's not doing today is he's not going to the climate change conference that everybody else is going to. That's not on the agenda.
Mr. Boone, who's the head of the United Nations now?
Something Ki Boone.
Yeah, Ki Boone. He has said explicitly climate change is the issue of the day, that we have to move ahead on this immediately. This is one of the biggest issues of the day. Good on him for saying it. I mean, the UN is holding this conference on this, and world leaders are from all over are here to.
It's a huge conference.
Pardon?
It's a huge conference.
Yeah, but so is Bush not there because he doesn't think that it would be necessary for him to be? Is this not a conference that it's Ban Ki-moon, by the way, the Secretary General. Yeah, is George Bush not there because other presidents and prime ministers are not there, and it's more of a scientist and kind of wonky person?
No, there are dozens of world leaders who are going to be there. No, he's skipping it. He's going to the dinner. No, he's having his own gathering of leaders later in the week. Basically, it's going to be a meeting with the same kind of goal, but a different idea of how to achieve it. His idea is that people should do this voluntarily. What he's doing is a parallel meeting, which he says does not compete with the UN process, or what his critics say is hijacking it. But basically, he has got a competing meeting going on, which is not in line with the UN meeting, and he's not attending the UN meeting.
So produce less carbon dioxide, hold your breath.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Make
all right.
Sure
and
your cows don't have any flatulence.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Now, Mr. Ahmadinejad is speaking at Columbia. I guess he's just wrapping it up. I've been reading the blog on the New York Times and sharing some of that with our listeners. The president of Columbia University pulling no punches at all with this guy. I mean, you know, really going after him. And you wonder to what extent he's doing that because he felt that he had to in response to all the media pressure versus he's doing that because, you know, in some ways, Mr. Ahmadinejad has made absolutely outrageous statements in the past that certainly should be called.
I found myself wondering the exact same thing, Tom. I don't know the answer to that, but I think he did a pretty good job of challenging Ahmadinejad, who responded in kind, as one would expect him to. I also thought I found myself agreeing with the president on one of those rare occasions when he said that it was basically, he thought it was okay for him to speak at Columbia.
George Bush said it's okay for Ahmadinejad to speak at Columbia?
He did say that. He said, this is a place of high learning, and if the president of Columbia thinks it's a good idea to have the leader from Iran come and talk to the students as an educational experience, I guess it's okay with me.
That's interesting, because all of his right-wing supporters have been just bloviating hysterically. We had one of them on here this morning, just going off the edge, you know. In fact, I was on Fox News this morning with Rich Lowry, and he's like, you know, wow, yeah, you would have invited Hitler over, wouldn't you? I don't think that this is quite the same thing. And right. You know, it was really quite surprising.
Astonishing.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, kind of under the radar screen, and this is something that concerns me a lot, that the same time that we're all noticing this issue of, you know, what's going on with Ahmadinejad, there's another story here. This over at the Huffington Post, I think it's the Yahoo News. While all eyes are on Manhattan, precious few are watching what's happening in Washington. On Thursday, Senators John Kyle and Joseph Lieberman filed an amendment to the 2008 Defense Authorization Bill that would make it official U.S. policy to, quote, combat, contain, and roll back Iran and its surrogates in Iraq. Section 5 calls for the United States to formally designate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization. If passed, this amendment would open the door even wider for military action against Iran. Is there much talk about this?
There's absolutely no talk about this at all. None. Zero, zip. And
wow.
When you couple this with the stories that have been coming out about Cheney trying to goad the Israelis into attacking, you come up with a pretty scary scenario.
Yeah, yeah. And yet there is some pushing back. Yeah, there is some pushing back. And I guess we need to be doing more pushing back. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great talking with you, Victoria. Thank you. Have a great day. Coming up tomorrow on the program, senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign, Rich Galen, is dropping by to tell us what's going on the Republican campaign trail. David Sirota will be here, one of my favorite writers. That and your calls on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People, fair and slightly unbalanced. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.